Let's start tonight's class. Tonight we're starting a new mini-course called The History of Halakha. This class is going to be a class that stands on its own, but it will also be a class that will act as a helpful preparation to next year's year-long course, Halakha B'Shana, course that will be looking at Jewish law as a whole over the course of the year, and will act as an introduction to how the Jewish legal system functions. We'll be looking at different types of laws, biblical, rabbinic, enactment, customs, and so on, and different types of laws of civil, agricultural, matrimonial, and so on. We'll be looking at all those different kinds of laws.
Yeah, next week is really a very different schedule.
Yes, so what's the schedule?
Services start at 7:30. Next week is the fast.
Oh, interesting. So maybe we'll do next week on Monday night. We might do next week on Monday night. We'll have to see. I'm going to have to decide. I apologize. I didn't realize
the
schedule.
Like I said, the rest of the general schedule is 6:45.
Okay.
So
we'll have to see. We'll have to see.
Send us an email.
Yeah, I'll definitely make sure the synagogue sends out an email. If you're on the general, I'll send to my list. If you're on the general synagogue list, you'll also get the email. And if not, if you're just curious what's going on, you can just shoot me a direct email, and I'll gladly tell you. Maybe we'll do that. Maybe we'll do that. That's a possibility. Yeah, maybe we'll do that. Yeah, it's a possibility. I love the eagerness. And so we'll be looking at, you know, a lot of different aspects. It'll basically be a class where the focus will be trying to understand how Jewish law really works. That I hope will eventually produce a greater appreciation of our legal tradition and how it really functions, how it changes, and so on and so forth. So that'll be next year. So this summer I wanted to talk a little bit about the historical development of Jewish law without really getting into too much of a discussion about exactly how the legal system works, to simply talk about how did it come about, which to some extent obviously those two things are related to each other. We're going to try to separate them just for the purposes of staying focused on topic. So we'll be looking at when different aspects of law came about as far as the major works of law. So you'll be introduced to the major works of halakha. So when during the course of the year I make reference to Rambam or to the Aruch HaShulchan or to the Talmud or so on, you'll know what book it is that we're talking about. We're going to talk about the major authors of the different books, and we'll be talking about also the different areas in which Jewish law developed, Ashkenazi, Sephardi, divergence, and so on, so that we'll all have a better sense of what are the major, who are all the players, and so on involved. So the next year when we start talking about these things, hopefully that will already be something that you'll be familiar with, and we'll be able to focus more on the content than on the context. Okay? We did a similar thing last summer with looking at the history of Jewish philosophy and then focusing on philosophy itself. So here we're talking about the history of halakha, and then during the year we'll be able to focus more directly on the halakha itself. Okay, any questions? Excellent, great. Okay, so to start our conversation, I did not quote within the handout many sources. In fact, I didn't quote any sources at all. Normally we like to incorporate some Torah sources. I'm going to make reference to certain Torah sources today, but there's a lot of content to get through that I felt like reading all the sources inside would limit our ability to do that. There's many sources to look at in reference to tonight's topic, no doubt. Just give you a sense, you can do a whole course on just the period we discussed this evening, as it usually is with most of the classes that we do. So if you feel so compelled or that you want to do further reading on tonight's topic, I have several books here that you can read. And those of you ask me, like, oh, are there any books that are a good introduction to next year's course? Some of these are excellent books to look at. They're a little bit, some of them are more complicated than others. But on page number 2, on the bottom, I have a bibliography. Those are these books over here. All of them are generally accessible, besides for the last one, number 5. This volume here by Menachem Alon on Jewish law is really a four-volume work which has been translated into English. You can buy it online for $400. So that one, and it's very detailed. It's a very high academic level, so I wouldn't necessarily recommend looking at this book. But some of these other books, primarily, this is a good one from Lauren Schiffman called From Text to Tradition, A History of the Second Temple and Rabbinic Judaism. This is a good sort of like intro to, again, the kinds of things we'll be talking about tonight, like a general introduction to the history of the Jewish legal system, and another nice book, which is a little bit less academic, but it quotes a lot of the Talmudic sources and so on about historical events. There's one volume that looks at the Second Temple period, another volume that looks at the period following the Second Temple until the period of the Gaonim. We'll talk about Gaonim next week. So this is also a nice book. Again, most of these tend to be a little bit more historical, but they, in that sense, act also as like a nice introduction to next year's course, where we'll be talking more about the halakha. So those are the books, some of the books I use to prepare for tonight's class. So enjoy. Okay, great. So starting with the question of Jewish law, where does it come from? Leslie, the first place we're going to talk about is that of the Bible, right? That of the Torah. We'll talk during the year about which parts of the Bible do laws come from, what is the status of laws that are derived from the five books of Moses versus the Nevi'im of the prophets and so on. But as a general corpus, the laws are derived from the Bible. In fact, the Bible is full of many laws. There are certain parts of the Bible where every other verse is another law. And then you have other sections of the Bible where you could go a whole, you know, four chapters and it mentions one law. But throughout the Bible in general, primarily after the time or part of the Bible, after the Exodus, is when you start having the major discussions of laws, right? The book of Genesis and the first half of the book of Exodus tend to be more stories. Afterwards, it's a mixture of stories and laws. In fact, Torah itself means the way, right? Meaning the way of life. And so the Torah is thought of as a legal work, even though we know it's really a combination of ideas and stories and laws all together. Now, while there are many laws within the Torah itself, there aren't many details. There are references to things that you shall and things that you shall not do, but it doesn't say precisely exactly how one should do those things and what exactly one should stay away from. And so, for example, it says, keep Shabbat. Okay. Doesn't really say what it means to keep Shabbat. It says, do not steal. Okay, easy enough, but how much does a person need to steal in order to be liable for punishment? You know, at what point have you done so much that you actually have transgressed something, right? If it says, don't eat on Kippur. So if you have a crumb, did you eat on Kippur? Do you have to have a whole sandwich? Right, meaning the parameters, right, the nuance, the way that you define exactly how one knows, have I fulfilled this, right? It says eat matzah on Pesach. How much matzah do I have to eat? So you go to the store now, you can buy a piece of paper and it marks on it. Eat matzah that fits this part of the page, right? And right, meaning the Torah doesn't say these things. The Torah doesn't tell us, you know, the parameters of the laws. There's really just these general presentations of the laws, but very few details. And certain laws do have more details that are on there. The laws of Shemitah, in that listing, there are more, the laws are presented. But by and large, with a lot of the laws, there aren't specifications. Right? It says, take a beautiful fruit on Sukkot. Doesn't say what kind of fruit it is. What does it mean to be beautiful? Right? None of these things are defined, right? And so the Torah is the source for the laws that, it leaves a lot of questions. It leaves a lot of things to interpretation when one studies the Bible. And so, in general, the Bible is viewed as one text through the Talmud and through the Halakha. Right? It's viewed as one text, and so there is this approach to see it, how it functions all together in one system. We'll talk a little bit more, obviously, during the year about exactly the way interpretation is carried out, and there's different principles, and we'll make a reference to that a little bit later, exactly how the approach of interpretation goes out. But from the Torah itself, it's not clear. Right, you just have the Bible, someone gives you a book, right? If an alien comes and says, oh, how do I keep Judaism? You give them the Bible, chances are they're not going to be able to figure it out. Right? I think somebody wrote some book called, like, Living the Bible. Living Biblically. The guy lived according to what the Bible said. It didn't look like Judaism, like we practice Judaism, right? It was a different way of life. I mean, the Bible itself does not translate into the way that Judaism is today. And in fact, it's almost laughable to think that it could. It's really very general kinds of statements. It clearly requires the need to interpret it. How that interpretation should work is not clear from the Bible itself. Now, when we talk about the Bible, we're talking about primarily the period, obviously, of the forefathers, the Exodus, entering the land of Israel, the first temple period, and then the beginning of the second temple period, up until, let's say, the 4th century BCE, 3rd century BCE, then the Bible is concluded, and then you have the next stage within that sort of process, which is where you start talking about, you have references, you know, in Jewish tradition to the men of the Great Assembly and the Zugot, the pairs. The rabbis, right, the period of, now we're no longer talking about the biblical works, we're now dealing with the period where you'll find texts of the Apocrypha and the Pseudepigrapha, right? If you look at, I mean, there are books that are published during this time period, but they're not part of our canon, right? They're not part of the Bible. Some of these books make their way into the Christian Bible, but this is no longer what we consider to be the biblical period. I have a series of lectures on the books of this time period that you can hear online. If you go to yutorah.org, there's a 4-part series I have there about the books that were written after the time of the Bible, before we start talking about the books of the rabbis, of the Mishnah, and so on. So if you want to learn a little bit more about those books, you can check out those classes online. But basically, you have this period after the Bible, but before we're talking about the books that we'll classically refer to when we talk about halakha, when we talk about Jewish law. And in fact, it's not because nothing was written during that time. There were books, and those classes talk about it. And you can go open up a Christian Bible, and you can see reference to different books that are written during that time period. And it's not because there was no activity during that time period. In fact, there is a lot of activity, and the Talmud itself talks about a lot of the activity that takes place during that time, despite the fact that none of the activity was formulated in a written corpus of literature. Some of those traditions will eventually be written down at a later time, we'll get to by the end of the class, but at that time, they're not really written down. And in fact, it shouldn't surprise us, there's a lack of clarity. There are differing opinions about what the interpretation of the Bible should be. How, in fact, it should be understood. There's no king, right, at this time. There's no it's certainly a different system. In fact, there is a court in the Sanhedrin, and there's different opinions among the people who sit on the Sanhedrin, who sit on the Jewish court. You find reference to this in the Talmud. You find references to this in Josephus, who is a Jewish historian of the first century of the Common Era, who talks about that there's different sects among Jews. Now, normally you talk about a sect, Usually that implies that there's like a primary group and then there's a sect. So when people tend to talk about this time period, sect really is everyone, right? In the sense that there doesn't seem to be any group which is really the dominant group. And so Josephus and the Talmud talk about several different groups of Jews living during the stage of the 2nd and the 1st century BC and the 1st century of the Common Era during those 300 years, and talks about a group of the Pharisees or the Perushim, the group called the Sadducees or the Tzedukim, the Essenes, who may be the Vaitusim of the Mishnah, and then of course the community in Qumran who published or who wrote the Dead Sea Scrolls. And so you have these different communities, and we know they're all Jews, and that they disagreed about exactly the way the Bible was supposed to be understood. They seem to all agree that it needs some kind of interpretation. Right? These are not the Karaites, who will be during the Middle Ages, who will say, live, you know, the Bible literally. Not that they're complete literalists either. You have to interpret. It's impossible. Anytime you understand a word, you're, in a certain sense, interpreting what that word means, right? So, but these groups seem to be doing, they all seem to be doing some kind of interpretation, but they disagree about what exactly those interpretations should be. Eventually, all those groups cease to exist, except for one of the groups, which are the Perushim, and from those Perushim will develop what we call the rabbis, right? And the rabbis who write the Mishnah, who write the Talmud, they certainly see themselves as being the heirs to this group during Bayit Sheni of the Perushim, which they see as being the true heirs to the earlier traditions of the first temple period going back to the times of Moses, right? They see themselves as, right, as the dominant group, and these other groups were splinters, you know, mistaken kind of things. It's unclear to us what really drove the difference of opinions during the Second Temple period. We don't have enough information about their disagreements to really get at, you know, was it simply one group interpreted a verse one way and the other group interpreted a verse another way? Just like in the Talmud, you have different, you have disagreements, and yet in the Talmud, they still consider each other as part of the same team, even though they disagree with each other. Why the different interpretations during Second Temple actually made each group feel like they were, in fact, different groups is not clear to us. Maybe it's because there were also political ramifications, you know, who was in control of the temple, who was, you know, if you were in control of the temple, it wasn't just, oh, how should we bring the sacrifices, but if you were in charge of the temple, that also meant that you were the liaisons to the Roman government. So maybe it's because there were politics mixed with religion that complicated it, or maybe no, the religious differences really did reflect somehow profoundly different approaches to how one goes about it interpreting or understanding the Bible. We don't know. We don't really know what exactly was happening. We know certain groups became very ascetic, the Dead Sea Scroll community, the Perushim were not ascetics, but they were very careful about purity and impurity. They separated, hence Perushim, which means the separators, not that they were separate from society. In fact, the Perushim, generally speaking, were known to be followed by the common people. And it was the Sadducees were followed by the aristocracy. So, you know, the little people won out eventually, right? And that's what bore what, you know, we look at today as what is referred to as Rabbinic Judaism, right? The Judaism as its practice post-temple. And so it's sort of this vague stage, you know, what exactly was the story with these difference of opinions during Bayit Sheni. But whatever the case may be, whatever exactly those differences were about, at the end of the day, those other groups stopped playing a role. A lot of those groups were what drove their sense of identity were sacrificial things. Certainly the Sadducees were very much related to the Kohanim, the priests with no temple. Those groups basically had no function. The groups, the Pharisees, who tend to be more about the common people who weren't the priests and so on, so they continued to be able to act as leaders and to have relevancy even after the Talmudic period, even after the temple period.
The Sadducees were very much like the Karaites, that they were only translations.
You know, that's the way they're sometimes presented. And in fact, there may be even comments in the Talmud that even almost want to say that that's what they are. When you actually look at what they say, that the Talmud quotes them as saying, they don't seem to be literates at all. They're clearly interpreting verses, they're just interpreting the verses differently. And again, I didn't quote the source here. I could show you stories where you see they say, oh, this, you do it this way, and the other group says you do it that way. And it's not that they're literalists. They're just interpreting the verse a different way. So Josephus talks about that. In fact, there were philosophical differences between the groups. And so that maybe is really what the differences were about. It wasn't that they had a different... I mean, there may have been disagreements about practical law, but it could be that isn't maybe what really drove the differences. Maybe what really drove the differences were the fact they had different philosophies, or did their different philosophies ultimately drive their different ways to interpretation? We don't know. We don't really know what the deal was. All we know is that the rabbis in Talmud see themselves as the followers of the Pharisees. The Pharisees are the real bearers of the original tradition, and these other groups, you know, basically were destroying Judaism. And thank God they no longer exist. And Judaism has survived and has carried on the way it was supposed to be. Right? That's the way that. But what really was going on? We don't know. Maybe that is the right narrative. Maybe it's not. But regardless, it doesn't make a difference because that is the that particular group went out. But regardless, again, who knows? Maybe what we do today is really a reflection of what all those groups did together. We don't really know. Whatever we know is the Talmud does present the story in that way, but clearly the groups were doing interpretation. Meaning the notion of interpretation is not something which is new. And so here we sort of get to the interpretation. You oftentimes hear references to rabbinic Judaism. And normally, I think it's an interesting term, because on one level, it's true that it's the Judaism of the rabbis, but it really carries this kind of like implication that like the Judaism of the rabbis is not the Judaism of the true Judaism. It's like, you know, this is the way Judaism was conceived by rabbis. Sort of like a negative. I mean, I see it as like a negative kind of like dig. It's like, oh, what we're all doing today is like, you know, that's just what the rabbis invented, but it's not authentic Judaism. So it's true, as we'll see, that certain things changed. There were some things that were accomplished by the rabbis, but to present it as like this altogether different, almost like religion, you know, to separate being like, oh, there's temple Judaism and rabbinic Judaism, is I think a very incorrect statement. It's really not. It's not fair to say that, because we have a lot of proof that many of, again, the notions or the guiding principles of quote-unquote rabbinic Judaism, meaning Judaism of the Mishnah and Talmud, were already in play at the very least during the Second Temple period. We don't have any information about the First Temple period aside from just what the Bible tells us, so there's no way to know for sure. But this notion of interpretation clearly existed during the First Temple period. There's a important Dead Sea Scroll that was found called the Miktsat Maaseh Torah, which is a little bit of the Torah. That's the translation of it. And in it, it presents the reason that the community in Qumran broke away. And in it, it articulates they broke away because this is the way that the service is supposed to be done in the temple. And they quote 20 different laws saying this is the way it's supposed to be, implying that in the temple, it wasn't being done that way, it's being done the opposite. And in fact, when one opens up the Mishnah, all the ways the laws are presented are in fact presented differently than the way that the community in Qumran said it should be done. Meaning, what's presented in the Mishnah is an accurate portrayal of what in fact was the way that Judaism was being observed in the temple during Second Temple times. Based on this information we have of this Dead Sea Scroll, which goes back to probably 150 BC. So, certainly during Second Temple period, interpretation was happening. There was, not just was there interpretation happening, but there was a sense about this is the way to do it. It wasn't simply just do what, interpret it however you feel. No, there clearly was already a sense that there is a right way to keep the Torah, and there is a way which is not the right way to keep the Torah. And there were disagreements about what was the right way and wasn't the wrong way. But this notion of halakha, of law, of interpretation, clearly was already inexistent during Bayit Sheni. So to sort of say like, oh, this thing was invented by rabbis, it's certainly not true. And maybe scholars will say that's not what they mean when they say rabbinic Judaism, but I think for most people when they hear that term, that's what it's implying. So about that, that's clearly not a correct... if that, in fact, is what the word means, then the word is wrong. Yeah.
Is it fair to compare the dissension that you're describing then to what we have today with Reform and Conservative and Hasidic and Modern Orthodox and not so modern? Is it that kind of dissension?
We don't know exactly what that dissension is about. What seems clear is that among those dissent, they all believe in... that the Bible is binding, right? That you have to do what the Bible says. That certainly is not true among different groups that you just mentioned today. So in that way, I would say it's certainly different, right, in that regard. Whether the difference between Sadducees and Pharisees is like Hasidim and Mount Orthodox, so... Hasidim probably might say that. I don't know that. Meaning, it depends what you view as the Sadducees. Do you view the Sadducees as this group which is outside the tradition? In which case, then I wouldn't want to say that. If you say no, Sadducees were just a different way of interpreting. The way the Talmud sees it, the Sadducees are not doing Judaism. So in that way, I would say, at least the way the Talmud sees it, I would not want to say that's true about us. But in that way, then, maybe then... the way the Talmud would see it, would say, oh, that is a difference between Reform and Orthodox, is the difference between a seat. It really all just depends like how you define what those groups really were about.
And we don't really know what they
are. We don't really know. We don't really know. Yeah.
We have the concept of interpretation, and then there's also the idea of something evolving. And often when we talk about the laws, we... one is said that, as they did in old, that they were much more, either authentic or truer or better. Sometimes the judgment ascribed to it. And yet the our scholars throughout the ages continue to interpret, and they interpret because it is evolving. So there seems to be a dynamic, sometimes contradictory, going on. What can you say about that? Is that...
I'm going to spend a whole year talking about that. No, that's a great question. I mean, that's a question. How does Jewish law work? And I think a lot of times the reason that we sense these contradictions are mostly because we're often... confusing is not the right word, but because we're not being, let's say, as precise as we should be, meaning evolution may make sense in certain areas of law, but not in other areas of law. But to just say it as, oh, Jewish law, there is or isn't evolution, it's a much more complex legal system, and depends what kinds of laws you're talking about and what kind of evolution, and what you mean when you say evolution. So I hope that at the end of next year, maybe we'll have a better sense about how to answer that. So again, that's not really what I'm getting into now. Now, that's a whole year course, which we'll do. Yeah?
I just wanted to ask if there are any written sources outside of the Talmud, which is after all kind of like history written by...
Yes.
Jews.
Right.
Are there written sources outside of the Talmud or what the other groups thought?
Well, again, so there's Josephus, but that's basically it. And Josephus himself seems to side with the Pharisees. So we don't have any... What we do have left over are texts from the Dead Sea Scroll community, which obviously describing what they're doing. So we do have those texts. And obviously they feel... They write very passionately that what they're doing is the right way to do things. So we do have some, you know, some of that knowledge. And it's still... There's huge amounts of that literature, and it's still... My understanding is still like a wide-open academic field. There's still a lot more research to be done and publication and, you know, reflection. So when we talk about, though, then the sort of like this period, and I'm not going to call it Rabbinic Judaism anymore because I don't like that term. We'll call this period of Chazal, which stands for Chachameinu Zichronam Livracha, our sages of blessed memory, which is a period, which is a reference to the rabbis of the Mishnah and the Talmud and so on. That's just the term which is used. So we talk about this period of Chazal. We are talking about a certain development, no doubt. For the first time, we're going to find areas of law defined in a written form. Does that mean it wasn't defined previously? Not entirely clear. But certainly during the time of Chazal will be a period of trying to at least articulate in a written form more defined interpretations. There are some additional laws that are added, gezerot, takanot, fences, enactments, rabbinic laws. It's a small group among the broader group of laws, but it does exist some additional laws as well. So in that way, there are certain things that are happening, but I see it more as sort of like an organic development as opposed to a revolutionary shift or some kind of seismic shift that's happening. There certainly was interpretation happening before. There certainly were leaders before. And there was a Sanhedrin for sure before that was dealing with cases of Jewish law. And it just now, it's for the first time being developed into a whole corpus, which will be written down. How exactly it was beforehand, was there more fluidity beforehand, more individual decision-making about performance? We don't exactly know. We don't exactly know how it looked, but certainly during this time, it's going to be more well-defined. Now, just sort of something to think about. When we talk about Jewish law, you know, we think of it in religious terms. But really, that was the law of the country. Meaning, just like America has a constitution, there's laws. And a certain sense, if you were to go to China, would you keep the laws of America? Probably not. You'd keep Chinese law. But we did. Right? We decided we're going to take our laws, and wherever we go, we're going to continue to keep our laws. We're sort of going to be a government in exile. Right? Wherever we go, we're going to maintain our laws. Once we didn't have a country, all of a sudden we looked like just a religion, like Christianity and Islam. But really, Judaism is the law of the Jewish nation in the land of Israel. And Nachmanides talks about that. Really, Judaism is supposed to be performed in Israel. Outside of Israel, it's like a little bit like keeping American law in China. It's like a little bit sense silly, but not that he's saying it's not binding, but it's not what it's meant to be. We're a people, we have a country, and in our country, these are the laws of our land. So we've wanted to maintain what our ideal way of a country should be run wherever we go, keeping those laws to the best of our ability while being respectful of the laws of the land that which we live in. And we'll talk about how that interplays during the year as well. So to some extent, it's finally, you know, it's almost, you know, taking this corpus, our legal tradition, and now that we're finally going into exile, saying, you know what, hey, if we want to preserve our laws, we're going to have to write them down. And it's unclear beforehand why they weren't written down. The Talmud presents it that almost there was a, it was almost prohibited to write down what they call the oral tradition, that there was a written tradition, that's the Bible, and the interpretations were not supposed to be written. Why not? Not sure. But the Talmud sort of presents it that it was something that was wrong, so maybe it was something intentional that it shouldn't have been written down, but certainly probably because it wasn't written down, it probably allowed for more what we call a mimetic tradition, where there was more of just sort of like traditions about the way you keep the Bible. Oh, this is the way I saw my mother keeping Shabbat, so this is the way I'm going to keep Shabbat, right? It wasn't text-based. It wasn't go to school and learn these. This is how you do it. I just know how to do it because that's what I do. I know on July 4th you set off fireworks and make a barbecue. That's just what you do on July 4th, right? I know when it's Sukkot, you shake these particular branches, and I know which branches to do because I saw my father go and collect these branches and shake them. Meaning, it could be that's just the way it was. It was just more of this kind of, there was this tradition, there was this understanding. In fact, that's the way the Talmud sort of tries to sometimes present it, is Torah Misinai, right? These traditions go back to the times of Sinai. This is just, we knew how to do it. We'll talk more in greater detail during the year about what exactly sort of, there is a debate about exactly how this works. But that there, because of that, there, maybe there was greater fluidity, maybe that permitted greater diversity of practice, and that was considered acceptable. But once we moved into the exile, there was this movement towards trying to define. Now, that brings us now to the first corpus of Chazal literature, right? Of rabbinic literature. So good question. So the destruction happens in 70 of the Common Era. We're going to start talking about written codes dealing in that second century of the Common Era, right? So during these, the 100 years after the destruction, you now start to find written documentation. Formulaic. Was it actually written down already then? Or was it just a memorized canon of literature that 400 years later was actually written down? We don't really know. We don't really know. Was the Mishnah written down when we say the Mishnah was written? Unclear. Meaning when we say it was written at a certain time period, it doesn't mean it was necessarily written on paper. Could it be it was memorized? There may have been at that time a value in memorization. That it could be there was a memorized, and 400 years later, it was actually written down. But the point is that at this stage is when this corpus of knowledge is formulated. And in that sense, it becomes, quote-unquote, written. So the first kind of literature that we find is that of Midrash. Now, when we talk about Midrash in this context, I don't mean Midrashic stories. Vashti had a tale. You know, the episodes of what happened, right? You know, I say, you know, jesting, but meaning we don't find those kinds of Midrash. We talk about those kinds of Midrash of stories. There's a term that we use for that. We call that Agadah. Stories. Midrash, Agadah. The Midrash of stories. Those are written down later. Those are from the 5th century of the Common Era. Those are going to be written by a group of rabbis of the Talmudic period, known as the Amoraim, the Amoraic rabbis. When we talk about now, we talk about the Tannaim, the rabbis of the Mishnah period, which is the 2nd century of the Common Era period. And the rabbis, the Tannaim, they write a certain kind of Midrash, not Midrash Agadah, not story Midrash. Oh, when Yaakov went to Esav and fought with the angel, what happened? Well, that's not what the Midrashim were concerned with. These were Midrash Halacha. These were the Midrash, the Halachic Midrashim. They were the biblical exegesis. Right? They went ahead and they saw a biblical verse and they interpreted it. Right? They did this biblical exegesis. They went through the Bible and they elucidated the meaning of the verse. And in fact, if you take the works of the Midrash Halakha, and we have them, many of them at least, it goes verse by verse by verse, saying what it means. And you could imagine, they were sitting in the yeshiva, And the Rebbe, right, was sitting there, and he read the pasuk, and he said, "This is what it means." He read the next pasuk, and he says, "This is what the pasuk means." And he went through pasuk by pasuk by pasuk, explaining, "This is what it means." And through that, that was how halacha was. Now, what exactly was happening when they did that? Was it, there was a tradition about how a mitzvah was supposed to be performed? And he was just showing how that practice that they saw in their home growing up, in fact, is what you see in the verse if you interpret the verse correctly. Or whether maybe no one really knew. And he's going ahead and saying, he's telling you, "I know how to read this verse. And I don't care what you saw at home. This is the way that it's supposed to be done." We don't know. It's probably a combination. It's probably a combination of the two. That some of them were coming along already with the end in mind. And some of them maybe were coming to, proactively interpret, how it is that one is supposed to keep the mitzvot. And maybe, again, certain things had never really been interpreted before, and people just did whatever they did, and now they're going ahead and saying, no, let's figure out what is the real way to do that. And there were principles that guided these methods of interpretation. We have in the Siddur, there's different countings of these midrashim. We have in the Siddur one of the countings of these principles of Rabbi Yishmael. We call the Yud Gimel Midot Shehatorah Nidreshet Bahen, the 13 principles by which the Torah is expounded. And it's read in the morning services. And it's different principles about when you have a general statement followed by a specific statement that tells you that the specific should determine how you interpret the whole. When you have a word in one place and you have the same word in another place, it tells you that those two places, in fact, have what to do with each other, even though they seem like totally different topics, and that if there's a certain principle by one, that same principle should be applied by the other. Different rules, principles that they use to help them interpret what, in fact, the Bible should mean. And so, basically, there was after that we have a Bible, we have a text, and the author of this text also supplied us with the techniques necessary to read that text. And these are the techniques. So now it's our job to take these techniques and apply it to the verse. And when we do that, it's not us saying what the Bible means, it's really God telling us what the Bible means, because we're using the principles that we have a tradition that are the basis for interpreting the Bible. And so the Midrash is that process of verse after verse of doing it. It seems to be understood by scholars that there were actually two different schools of exegesis. There was a school of Rabbi Yishmael, and there was the more extensive Midrashic school of Rabbi Akiva. And when today a person goes to the store and says, "Oh, I'd like to purchase a copy of the Midrash Halakha," and you get your volumes, it's actually a combination of the two. Not mixed within each book, but the different volumes. The one you'll get on Exodus, the one you'll get on Vayikra, the one you'll get on Bamidbar, the one you'll get on Devarim, in fact, are not all written by Rabbi Yishmael. They're not all Rabbi Akiva. Some are Rabbi Akiva's school. Some are Rabbi Yishmael's school. But we've lost some of the other ones, and now they've sort of been viewed as one corpus of literature. But they actually are from the two. If you look on page number 2, there's a chart there, Midrash Halakha, and it shows you here what we in fact have of the different books. You're interested to note, there's none on Genesis, right? There's none on Bereshit. And it's because there's no primarily laws in Bereshit. Right? The laws start. So in fact, the Midrash Halakha starts with the Exodus from Egypt. Right? It doesn't talk about the slavery. With the Exodus is where the Midrashim start their process of interpretation, because that's really where laws first appear in the Torah. When you talk about Midrash Agadah, which will be written by the Amarim, all of a sudden that starts with the beginning of Bereshit, as you'd expect, right? Because they're trying to just tell you what the stories mean. Now, We then find that. So that's the Midrash. That's the Midrash that we find.
Excuse me.
Yes.
What you have written in bold, is that the stuff that's included? Is that what you meant to say? Are you bold with some of them?
Yes. Those are the ones that generally you will buy when you buy Midrash. Okay. This is sort of like a more recent realization that this is, in fact, what the books are that we have. Someone was studying it. I forget which scholar of the last century was studying the books, and he identified that, oh my gosh, these are different. These are clearly written by different schools. And he developed certain principles that guided the way that you know which in books reflect which schools. But in any case, they both became part, ultimately accepted from our tradition. and so this is where it gets interesting. So when you look at, so look at sort of page 2. So here you have Rabbi Akiva, and it shows you, right, the famous Rabbi Akiva, and it shows you many of his students. His students go on to write a lot of different books. And these books will be formulated differently. Rabbi Akiva is attributed with being the great organizer of Jewish law. But you look in the Bible, there's references to Shabbat in 10 different places. So what, you gotta look at this book of Midrash Halakha, then you gotta open up the other volume, you gotta open up all these volumes, put your stickies and all these different pages, combine all of them, and then you can finally figure out what are the laws of Shabbat. So Rabbi Akiva is known for being the one to start synthesizing, to start saying, wait, I'm going to teach you the laws of Shabbat in one class. I don't have to teach 10 different classes on different parts. In one class, I will tell you the laws of Shabbat. I will synthesize all those different verses from all different places in the Bible and present to you in an organized, coherent fashion how Shabbat is supposed to be done. And so it's from Rabbi Akiva's school that the halakha tends to follow more than, let's say, the school of Rabbi Yishmael. And in fact, one of his major students, Rabbi Meir, is often quoted in the Mishnah, and it's from his student. His student was Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi, who is considered to be the compiler of the Mishnah. The Mishnah is a remarkable work. If you look on page number 3, I have here a Talmud Mishnah chart. If you look at the left column, the far left column, it says Seder, order. There are 6 orders. It goes from page 3 to page 4. There is Zeraim, there is Moed, Nashim, right? You have laws of agriculture, festivals, matrimonial law, turns to the next page, damages, temple service, and purity laws. He formulated, seemingly, certainly his students formulated Jewish law into 6 broad categories, and within each category, they broke it down, refined it even more. We talk about festivals, well, there's Sukkot, and there's Rosh Hashanah, and there's Kippur, right? They broke Pesach, and they end up compiling presentations of the law, not based on biblical verse, but based on conceptual categorization of the laws. And they organize that into the Seder, which means the order. They finally put everything in order, right, in a certain way. And these works, the Mishnah, popular to study today, they're written in the, what's called Mishnaic Hebrew. It's a simple, easy-to-read kind of Hebrew. So it's very popular to study. It's organized. It's well organized. Basically, goes through all the areas of Jewish law and say, then this is how you do this. Then, if in this situation you do that, it's less interested in defining what biblical verse each law is set on. It's more a guide. This is do this, do that, do the other thing. You know, when you're walking on the way and all of a sudden your ox gores his cow, this is what you do. And, oh, but if it's a goat, you do something else. And it just sort of goes through and tells you what the laws are in the different situations. Yeah?
Why did you say Talmud
Mishnah? I'll see that. We'll get to Talmud. I'll get to that. Okay? And in that sense, it's important. It's in categories. It's comprehensive. And it's written in a very practical way. It basically presents the traditions of the school of Rabbi Akiva. It's no doubt that we put Rabbi Akiva on such a pedestal. He really is considered to be this great teacher. However, one of the important things about the Mishnah and the making it so important is it does record dissent. It records dissent. It records differing opinions. It'll say the halakha, and then it'll say, oh, but Rabbi Yossi thought this. It'll quote the halakha and say, oh, but Rabbi Yochanan, or whoever, right? It'll go through and it'll quote the dissenting opinion. In sort of classic literature, that is unheard of. That pluralistic kind of perspective of saying, hey, it may not be the majority rule, it may not be the popular view, but we want to put it down also. That should be recorded as well. It should be known that there was another position on this particular matter. Great sense of respect for diversity of opinions. The rabbinic tradition is very powerful in that it preserves dissenting view, very different from Roman law and so on, where it's just presented. This is what the law is, right? Don't do this off the hand, right? Now, here they're presenting different legal traditions, even though it generally presents one as the preferred way to do it, the popular, the majority view about the way a particular law is supposed to be performed. I'll get to that. Okay. Now, there's other texts that we have from the Mishnaic period written by Tannaim. We have the Tosefta, which you can find in the back of a volume of the Talmud. It's similar to Mishnah. And we also have other texts that do not appear in the Mishnah. In the Talmud are generally referred to as a Braita. Sometimes this Braita is a Tosefta. Sometimes the Braita is a text that doesn't appear anyplace else. Maybe it's a text that appears in one of the Midrash Halakha. Maybe it just doesn't appear anywhere. It's simply a teaching from the Tannaitic period that's not in the Mishnah itself. Right, so you have Mishnayot, and then you have Braita. Braita is sort of a catch-all for anything which from the Tanaim, which is not part of the Mishnah. The Mishnah really became the cornerstone, the primary text or teachings from the Mishnaic period, even though there were other teachings from that time, some of which we have preserved independently, some of which only exist as scattered teachings in the Talmud. So that brings us to the Talmud. We're talking about the 4th, 5th century of the Common Era. And there, the Talmud is analysis. The Talmud, rabbis of the Talmud have studied the Mishnah. And they want to go back and they say, okay, we've inherited this accepted teaching about how Judaism is to be performed. But where did it come from? When Rabbi so-and-so said, this is the law, why did he say that was the law? How did he interpret the verse? Because shouldn't the verse be interpreted otherwise? And so now it's sort of, the Talmud is now worth stepping backwards, saying, they're telling us the practical, now let's go back and understand again, what was that biblical interpretation that the Mishnah was based on? Because the Mishnah doesn't quote what interpretation drove them. Or the Mishnah reflects maybe certain principles of law. Almost, it starts at this point, not just being, the Mishnah also does, where it'll tell you a principle. Not just a specific law in this case, it'll tell you, you know, whenever you have this kind of thing, this is what to do. So Talmud would say, is that really the principle? But we learn from Rabbi Yochanan, the principle is like this. Another rabbi will say, Rabbi Yochanan didn't say that. My teaching was that Rabbi Yochanan taught differently. And they'll say, well, Rabbi Yochanan couldn't have said that because we have another Mishnah over there that presents Rabbi Yochanan, and it seems like Rabbi Yochanan over there, his position only makes sense if he believed X. And then it says, no, you don't have to believe X to believe Y. If you believe Z, you could also believe Y. And so it goes around and around trying to identify what is the principle that stands behind the statements of the rabbis. Because once we understand what the guiding principles are, then we can go ahead and figure out how the law should be practiced in a scenario that doesn't exist in the Mishnah. Maybe there's a case in the Mishnah that's not presented. Maybe we have a new technology that didn't exist in the times of the Mishnah. In the 2nd century, they didn't have this, but in the 5th century, we do. So we have to know when the Mishnah says, when it seems the majority rule is A, what is the principle behind A, so we know how this should apply to a new situation. Right, so the Talmud is full of analysis, trying to figure out what it is. Sometimes it says, oh, even though the Mishnah presents one approach as the dominant view, it's actually not true. The dissenting view in the Mishnah really is the primary view, and they'll come to that conclusion. And so it's basically this approach, because again, the Mishnah is sort of presented from one school. It's the primary school, but the Talmud is trying to sift through and figure out really what is the final approach. And so generally speaking, the Talmud is interested in doing analysis, in figuring out principles, in figuring out who really said what, and what did they really believe, and in identifying which is the dominant view, with the goal of basically figuring out what the law should be. Now it's going to be the role of then the rabbis of the Middle Ages to figure out what does the Talmud conclude in that discussion? We're actually not sure what they really conclude. There was this whole discussion, and it's actually a little confusing. And were they actually agreeing with Rabbi Yochanan, or were they agreeing with Reish Lakish? And so, we'll get to that when we talk next week about start getting to the medieval period. But that's what the Talmud is about. The Talmud is this debate of analysis, of an analytic understanding of the teachings of the Tannaitic period.
Isn't the Talmud a reflection of new conditions in Babylonia?
So sometimes it is. Sometimes the Talmud will say, what do we do in this case? This is a new situation. And so that's why they need to go to the Mishnah to figure out when the Mishnah said this, or when Rabbi so-and-so said this, why did they say that? The why is really important, because the why will tell me what I should do in my situation. Right? It could be he did that over there, but my situation maybe is different than his situation, and so it should be different. So that's what the Talmud is trying to get at. Now, there's two Talmuds. There's a Talmud that was completed in Israel in the end of the 4th century, and then there's a Talmud which was mostly completed in Babylonia at the end of the 5th century. Generally speaking, we consider the Babylonian Talmud to be the more important Talmud, the Talmud that we rely on more so to figure out what our tradition should be, for a number of reasons. One, because it came later, so there's a sense that they knew what the Jerusalem Talmud said. If they didn't conclude that way, it must be there was a sense that that was not the way it should be, and so it came later, and so we give it greater credit for that. And also, eventually, the community in Israel, the reason it concludes is because basically the community in Israel is going to have persecution with the rise of Christianity, and the dominant community in the world will be the Babylonian Jewish community, and because of that, the Talmud that they codified, that they put together, will basically, Jews throughout the world will eventually be the descendants of that Jewish community, for the most part, of Babylonia. And so those Jews will take the Babylonian Talmud wherever they go. And so that becomes the major, the most influential of the Talmuds. We still have the Jerusalem Talmud. It plays a role in conversation. The medieval scholars look at it. They debate it. Sometimes they do follow Jerusalem Talmud. But for the most part, it's the Babylonian Talmud, which is the most important. And so in Yeshivot and so on, that's the Talmud which is generally studied. Jerusalem Talmud is more looked at. If they're studying something in Talmud and they know it discusses Jerusalem Talmud, so then they'll look at that also. But for the most part, until you become very scholarly, in Yeshivot, you're not even looking at Jerusalem Talmud. You're really just looking at the Talmud Bavli, the Babylonian Talmud. And so, if you look at back of the sheets, so in that middle column, we have BT and JT. So BT is Babylonian Talmud. JT is the Jerusalem Talmud. And you can see a difference between the Mishnah and the Talmud. Where you see a flat line, it means that there is no Talmud on that. So there is no Talmud on agricultural laws, besides for Brachot. Why would that be? They don't apply outside the land of Israel. So the Talmud, the intense analysis, they're interested in laws that are relevant to them. So the Talmuds don't appear on every tractate of the Mishnah. There's more tractates of Mishnah than tractates of Talmud. Now sometimes, many times, in tractates of Talmud, they'll quote teachings from other Mishnayot that don't have Talmuds dedicated to them. There's plenty of discussions in the Talmud about sacrifices, but there isn't, for the most part, Talmudic tractates on the sacrificial tractates. You'll find a little bit more in Jerusalem Talmud, small tractates on those, which makes sense. They were still living in Israel, even though those things weren't maybe as relevant anymore, but still, they had a stronger tradition. And so scholars are often interested in the Jerusalem Talmud when you look at stories of the Second Temple period that are quoted in the Babylonian Jerusalem Talmud. Often greater credit is given to the presentation in the Jerusalem Talmud because there's an assumption that maybe their stories have greater clarity of memory because they were written in the place where those things happened and there wasn't moving around that took place. So maybe it reflects a more authentic tradition. Some people say maybe because that specifically it doesn't, because they, whatever. Each time it's always a different conversation. But it's interesting here, you can see that the most part, the Talmud is on Sabbath and festivals, matrimonial law, laws dealing with damages, civil laws, and also interestingly on temple service, but not so much on purity laws, which, while we do have family purity laws, which it does appear on Nidah, but most of the other laws of purity had to deal with temple-related things, and so for that, it doesn't appear. So the Mishnah is inclusive of everything. The Talmud is more focused on the things that actually mattered to practical living. So, in conclusion, we sort of look at this period from the Bible through the Talmud. It seems to reflect a transition from fluid to form, right? That you have laws in the Bible. It's not clear what they are. Maybe there is an accepted tradition, even at the early times, of how those things are to be practiced, but it's not written down. And because it's not written down, it allows, perhaps, for greater fluidity, meaning at one time, maybe it's interpreted one way, and another time, perhaps, the rabbi consensus is to interpret differently. After the close of the Talmud, basically the consensus of the Talmud will become defining, right? There afterwards isn't going to be a going backwards and saying, you know, even though on that particular debate, majority of the rabbis of the Mishnah felt one way, and only one rabbi felt another way, you know, we actually think the rabbi thought, you know, individually, we actually think he's right, so, you know, we're going to follow him. Now, after the close of the Talmud, there's a general sense that whatever the consensus was of the Talmud, that is going to direct us on how we're supposed to follow. We no longer sort of have there's more this sense that there's a, we no longer have the skills or the authority to go back and interpret ourselves. How does biblical interpretation work? I've got no idea. We don't know. We have the principles, but how the principles really work, how they guide us, we're not really sure. We're not entirely sure. And so we basically say, you know, whatever the conclusion of the Talmud was, they clearly spent a lot of time working on this. Their conclusion will be our conclusion. Does that mean in times of, you know, Messiah or return to Israel, we'll set up a Sanhedrin? Maybe once again they'll debate the issues and they'll be able to sort of reinterpret a biblical verse again. But we don't reinterpret biblical verses. We have presentation of different agreements, but we generally follow the dominant view on those issues. And then that becomes dominant to us. If that was the dominant view in the rabbis of the Mishnah and the Talmud, it's okay. So that's good enough for us.
Basically it means that currently we have no contributions to make. I mean, everything is essentially from 1500 years, you know, thousand years ago, whatever it is, we have no contribution to make.
Well, we do have a lot, and that's something we're going to look at. I mean, obviously, we have a lot of issues that the Talmud didn't discuss. And so that'll become a whole discussion about what do you do with those kinds of situations. But we are not we're not going to recreate the wheel again. We're not going to go back and figure out what does it mean when it says take a beautiful fruit on Sukkot. And for us to say, you know what, I think it means an apple. You know what, they thought it was an etrog. It's an etrog. We're not going to go back and, you know, rehash old arguments. Right? They went through it. They spent a lot of time doing it. We're not really sure exactly how interpretation works. In fact, they, you know, had a more of a stronger chain to that. Obviously, with so many exiles that we've gone through, there's been a lot of been lost in a certain sense along the way. And so we say, you know what? They did it. They worked really hard at it. Whatever their dominant view is, that's going to be the dominant view. Even though it can be frustrating, right? Clearly, at times. But it's almost like even if we wanted to, we don't know how to some extent. But there's still a lot of debates. Believe me, plenty of debates go on in the Middle Ages, go on still till today. So there's still a lot of things that are unclear even after Talmudic period. Yeah. It seems to be sort of like this consensus, almost like as this stuff was collected, it was almost just maybe this growing sense among the people of, you know, I don't know, they discussed this 100 years ago, like, well, I'm going to talk, like, I don't know, they discussed it, this is what they concluded, and I guess there was just that sense. You know, certainly around that period is going to be the rise of Islam, so it's...
There isn't someone's name associated.
There is someone who's like people who are associated as sort of the editors of the Talmud. But still we know that even after the end of the Talmudic period, this period of the Savoraim, which happened after the rabbis of the Talmud, before the rabbis of Gaonim, who we do know do make some edits still to the Talmud. But there seems to be, so it's not like it happened one day. It seems to be like sort of this... The close of the Talmud happens over like a 150-year period. So no, there isn't one person, but it's like a growing kind of consensus that that's what it is.
I'm still confused. So you have Mishnah, which is a book you study, and it's got these categories that are the same, and then the Talmud goes back to it and incorporates that?
And interprets what the basis was of the Mishnaic law.
But you're saying this is all... Is all of this is in the Mishnah in this format?
The Mishnah covers all those topics.
And the Talmud does again.
The Talmud does it, goes through it, takes the Mishnah, and then Mishnah will be four lines, and Talmud will go for four pages.
Okay.
Saying, you know, the Talmud, the Mishnah says, this is the law of the situation. The Talmud will say, well, why did he say that? What was the guiding principle?
Okay.
And are there other people who maybe disagreed with that Mishnah? And even though the Mishnah says that, maybe that isn't the dominant view. And that's something that Talmud incorporates other texts besides for just even what the Mishnah has to say in order to sort of reach an independent then kind of conclusion.
And what's the group of rabbis for you?
Amoraim.
Yes.
Yeah. Yes. It's a lot of information.
You got the Bible, and it's like the Mishnah's writing. The Bible and the Talmud, the writing around the Mishnah.
Yeah, you could sort of say, look at it that way, yeah.
It helps me to understand.
Or you have the Bible, then you have the Mishnah, and then you have the Talmud, however you want to look at it, right?
And where does the Midrash come in?
So the Midrash forms sort of like the basis on which the Mishnah was written. So almost you could look at it as Bible, Midrash, Mishnah, Talmud. You could look at it that way. Okay, great. Thank you all. Thank you all so much. I haven't decided exactly so much. I'll send out an email. I'll try to do Tuesday if we can before the fast is over, maybe an hour before Minchah, something like that. I apologize if that messes with anyone's schedule, but I'll record it. And so. If anyone has any questions, I'm happy to answer now.